Welcome to the TechNori Podcast. Today's show is sponsored by ActiveCampaign. Go beyond email marketing with True Automation by signing up at ActiveCampaign.com/TechNori. Get your first 2 months for free. Today's show's guest, Chuck Svoboda. He is Marquette University Innovator in Residence, also podcast host, author, speaker, corporate leader. Kind of just like mulled over the fact that he was the CEO and chairman of Cree, which is the creator of pretty much every LED light bulb on the planet. Public company, pushing what, $5 billion plus market cap. So kind of a big deal. But one of the things about Chuck that I think is so unique is just his relatability. And normally, and I have a lot of experience in this, fortunately or unfortunately, however you want to look at it, at Northwestern, going back to student lecture stuff and talking at the university, I've done some of this at Marquette and I mentor kids at Marquette as well. A lot of the people who come back into the academic world either do not experience extreme success like I would say Chuck has, or if they have, they're not relatable. They kind of come down and they just talk at people and they tell stories. And I think that it's not like the most advantageous. And it's also, we get into this during the show, it sort of lends itself to a crutch mentality where you sort of make it easy on people because you can and you have the ability to tell them beforehand where the step is so that they don't fall. And Chuck is not like that. Not that he's not telling you where the step is. He is, but he's telling you more about why. And I think it's just one of those things. We talked about on the show a little bit about the fact that it is something that is almost innate in you. It's a trait you have. It's a way of thinking. It's not an action. Being innovative, being an entrepreneur, it's not something you do. It's the way that you go about something. And Chuck is like that example. He's a person who tells a little anecdote about when they were hiring at Cree, and this company is going through this like massive innovation. And if you worked at a company for a really long time, it was sort of a sign that maybe you wouldn't work out well here. Not a judgment, good or bad, just a fact. And I think that sort of thought process is something that is unique. And I think it's one of the things that's kind of missing from the education component right now is kids are not being exposed to leaders like this. And so this conversation, I think, is particularly unique and interesting to me because I went to Marquette University for undergrad, but also because I spend so much time working with young entrepreneurs that I wish that more of our business leaders got more involved in a practical sense. And so this conversation with Chuck, I think you're going to greatly enjoy. So here is my interview with Chuck Svoboda, the former chairman and CEO of Cree and now Marquette Innovator in Residence. So it's been a little while since I saw you last. Good to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks. Great to be back in Chicago.
I apologize for my wearing a Northwestern shirt while you're wearing our Marquette alum shirt. Not a great day to have my dog walk on my shirt, but nonetheless.
Hey, it happens.
And so I think this is going to be an interesting conversation, not only because of your very successful experience at Cree, but also my experience working with Northwestern and Marquette, both Innovation Lab and the Garage, and your experience now as an innovator in residence at Marquette, which I want to talk about that title also and just get into that whole thing and learn all about what you guys are doing at Marquette. But I would love to jump like head first into this conversation because you said something when we were getting ready to go here that I think needs to be said, like shouted at the rooftop. We're only 18 floors up, so we might have to go up a little higher. That entrepreneurship and innovation is a way of thinking. It's not a title. It's not a thing you do. And I think that universities first, because they're the trainers of future employees, and then companies really need to get behind this understanding that you're like, you're not hiring for innovation, you're hiring innovators. There's a difference. Talk a little bit about your beliefs in this, and then we'll bring context later.
Yeah. So when I was putting together the book, which was really a description of, you know, what did I do at Cree? What did I see done at Cree that worked? I was trying to figure out what are the common themes. And what I realized, it was about people. It wasn't about what we did. It was about how people thought. And that's where that concept comes from. And so what you get into is you really get into a conversation about mindset. And the challenge I think we have is that so much of what people want to teach is a process to do something. Because frankly, it's kind of easy to do that, right? Yeah. Follow these steps and you get there. It's actually really hard to teach a process of thinking.
Yes.
And so what
I call it learn to learn. And yeah. I think a lot of, we're talking about education here a lot, so I don't want to come across as education basher, which I've been accused of a time or two. I think that we're going all the way back to, like, my wife teaches high school chemistry, and I have this conversation with her all the time. I'm sure she loves it, where I dog on the schools on their education programming, because I think we're not teaching kids and people and adults how to learn. And I think that's a fundamental thing.
Well, so if you think about, you know, the example I like to use is, think about what is innovation, right? You're going to do something new, right? It's never been done before. And typically you're going to have to go solve some really hard problem. And in the end, you have to make it relevant. You got to actually create some value.
Yep.
Well, if you have all those three elements, how do you learn to do that? And you don't learn to do that by there's a right answer and you try to solve for that right answer. And think about it, our whole experience is about solving a problem, teaching someone how to get a right answer. By definition, you don't know what the answer is when you're going to pursue innovation.
Yep.
So you have to have a different way of thinking about it. And you know, the analogy I came up with, I was recently spent some time with a startup accelerator in Raleigh, North Carolina. Okay. And they take entrepreneurs through their program. And as we talked about what they're doing, kind of one of the ahas I had was they've designed a program to help people be successful. And yet most successful entrepreneurs or innovators are successful because they have learned how to deal with failure.
Yep.
And you can't actually learn how to deal with failure if someone keeps helping you succeed.
Yes.
So it's a learned this mindset is learned. And so what we did at Cree was we would look for people that already had it, right? We were in a hurry. We wanted people that were already biased that way. But if you go back and look at why people become this way, it's a set of life experiences. And so one of my arguments or ideas is that whether it be in the education system or even what we do to support startups, we shouldn't be trying to help them all succeed. We'd be trying to push them to fail, and their best ones will learn to overcome. Because, you know, we talk about things like resiliency. Yep. How do you build that up? It's a learned behavior. This is – I don't know why we think these ideas are any less learned than anything else.
I totally agree. And for those who are listening who are unaware of Cree, if you're reading the book and you look up and the light that's helping you read is probably created by Cree.
Yeah, these lights in the studio are probably our LEDs as well.
There's about a 99 to 100% chance that that's the case. And so this is a company, we'll get into your background a little bit on this as we go here, but I want to spend some time on this topic because I do think you're right. I think, and this goes back to education and children, but this also goes to businesses in general. The enablement slash crutch, I think, is something that I don't want to even call it a – I don't even know the right way to put it, because I don't want to say that you don't want to assist people, because you don't want people to get down to the point where they don't feel like they can get out. But I also think, like, it's sort of, as an investor, when somebody pitches me and I look at their history and I don't see any sort of struggle, I don't see any sort of like your back was up against it, I can't bet on you, because I know the shit's going to hit the fan. I don't know when, and I really don't know what you're going to do when it happens, and I can't believe in you until I do. And I think that companies are, in schools too, everybody's a little bit reticent to let people be tested.
Well, look, the system's designed to help promote success.
Sure.
I mean, it's just how it's built. It's not right or wrong. It just is what it is, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I always try to explain to people, if you want to pursue innovation, you have to recognize that you've been trained to think in a way that's kind of counter to that. So you've been taught there's a set of rules, follow the rules, get a right answer. The goal is to get 100% on the test. Well, you know, when I was looking for people that wanted to innovate, if someone could get me two right answers, or someone could try five things, and if they got one or two right, I will take the three wrong every time.
Yeah, yeah.
Because every time you get something wrong, the really good people learn something. And it meant that the things they got right were actually better, because there's knowledge being gained. You know, it's this idea that, you know, as I've started getting to meet a lot of innovators, and I ask all of them, you know, what their biggest failure was. And the common theme in all of them is they have no trouble describing all kinds of things that went wrong, but they almost always connect it to this concept of learning. So what they saw it as is something they tried, it didn't work, but what they remember is what they learned and how they reapplied it. And to me, that's what I was looking for in people to help us run a company built around innovation. In fact, that was one of my interview questions. I want to know more about, give me an example of one you failed, really describe it to me, and then what did you learn? And people that couldn't do that, I knew enough to know that we just weren't going to go there.
Yeah.
Because it didn't matter that they could learn it. We didn't have time. And so just like you're looking for an investor that's had something go wrong and overcome it, that's what we're looking for, right? It is a learned skill set.
Oh, I totally agree. And I would also say that I think there's, from a corporate standpoint, I think that there's a process that needs to be put in place that enables sort of it harnesses the learning. It sort of filters out some of the stuff that's, you know, it's like a little bit of a suspension there so that you don't bottom out. And I think the companies that don't have that sometimes end up reckless, and the ones that have a little too much of it are not very innovative. There's this like balancing act, which I think you build first at Cree or wherever it is, and then you hire the people that are going to be the right fit for the mechanism, the mousetrap you've built. Is that, do you feel like that, or do you think it's like mostly just people?
At Cree, it was people. There was the original founders. I'm not one of them, but yep. The original five founders
weren't far off though. It was 87 founded, 93 joined.
Right. When I got there, we had $6 million in revenue and about 30 people. But the original five guys that started it, that spun it out of NC State, they're wired different. They are. They have this ability to. They don't see risk the same way we see it. They're completely unafraid of trying something and it might not work. It just that doesn't even occur to them. And then they're driven to succeed at a level I also think we're missing, because the two go together, right? The goal isn't to fail.
Yeah.
The goal is to succeed. But you got to be comfortable that you're going to fail and then have this drive to get there. The way I described it is, I wanted people who were unafraid of failure, but they were unwilling to fail. And it's that combination.
Yep.
And so for us, if we got the right people, even if they didn't know a lot about the problem we were trying to solve, we could make them successful. If we got people that were really smart about the technology, but they weren't wired the right way, it didn't work. Yep. And in fact, for a long time, we had a rule we wouldn't hire people that had worked at large companies for very long. Because by definition, if you stay at a large company for any long period of time, you've accepted some set of boundary conditions. You've learned to make the system work. And it doesn't make it bad or good. It just makes you...
But like complacency is certainly something that does not affect you in a way that would affect me.
Right, yeah. And you've learned to settle or accept things are good enough. I needed people who weren't. So if someone worked at a big company and they had quit after a few years, we were interested. If someone had been there 10 years and were talking to us, we tried it. We hired people, some of the smartest people from IBM and GE and other great companies. They were unsuccessful in our environment, especially in, I will say, the first 10 or 20 years.
Yep.
As we became a bigger company, it became different. In fact, when we became a bigger company, we had the same problems that I was trying to avoid when we started out.
Oh, that's...
Because what makes you good at managing an organization, what makes you good at delivering a predictable result, makes you bad at innovation.
Yep, totally. No, and I think it's interesting that you bring this up, because I find it fascinating that individuals, the very, very successful people we've had on the show, one of the most recent ones I think that comes to mind is Mark Randolph, the co-founder of Netflix, talking about when they're scaling this company up, how micro they looked at things. Like, they would look at the things that you and I would be like, well, probably not you and I, but the average person would be like, what a stupid thing to get like hung up on. What a petty thing. And it's like, no, it's kind of a microcosm of like everything we do. And so if you exemplify these things, there's a really high probability that it just is not going to work out well. And so they just cut it right there. It's just cut and dry. It has to be this way, and we're just going to go with this. And I think that there's a certain clarity of mind that individuals have that are great leaders, because they're like, no, I need to figure out what is the best filter. And for me, what I have noticed as a trend is that if you worked at a long time at this company, probably this is not a good fit for you. So now we transition this conversation and your career over towards helping others and working to educate and train other people. How do you instill the knowledge and the learnings that you've had from this into kids at Marquette? In other words, like, because I personally think, as a Marquette graduate, I'm sure everyone at Marquette's going to listen to this, and I don't know if this is good or bad for me, but like what they did for me that I thought was very unique was that we had some of the same books as my friends who went to Northwestern and U of I and all these other things, and schools that are quote unquote ranked higher, but we always thought like we were competing with Notre Dame. And when I first went to Marquette, I was like, what are you talking about? Like, Notre Dame is like, right, Ivy League, whatever. I have now worked with one of our sponsors, B of A, little shout out to Bill Fritz, as a Marquette guy. A bunch of my friends who work in the VC world are Marquette guys. They run laps around the Fighting Irish guys that I know of, because the work ethic is just ridiculous. And I think that Marquette does a fantastic job of training people to be a hard worker, sort of that Jesuit education. But where some of the schools like this lack is having the reach and the network sometimes that like a Northwestern or Notre Dame might have. Where Marquette has this position to really, I think, blow the wheels off stuff is by providing insights from people like you that can't be gotten somewhere else. It's not about network. It's just, you know something. You're different. You're cut from a different cloth. So I'd love to know what you're doing as innovator in residence and how you view the opportunity to shape a lot of the students that are coming through Marquette now.
Yeah, so, you know, there's an interesting stat, and I don't have it the exact one off my head, but Marquette, if you look at the size of the school and the number of graduates, we have a disproportionate number of CEOs who come from Marquette. So you ask yourselves, well, wait a minute now. So you don't graduate with that
network. Marquette and Ohio State are the two, like, strange, but, like...
Right, but, so, but when you leave Marquette, right, we don't have the same network as someone from Notre Dame or an Ivy League school. And so what is that? And as I've studied it over the last year, I think it is something to do with what a Jesuit education is. I think part of what's happening is that you're developing part of this idea of the how you think, like we started with. I think it's actually back to that idea. So, you know, there's not – when you're sitting there being challenged on – I'm an engineer, but I was taking classes like philosophy and theology. And most of my engineering counterparts never took those classes.
Right.
I didn't like them when I was there. But those are thought process classes. And so I think there's an experience that's being created, first of all, and just kind of how the core goes about it, right? So I think there's a rounded – there's something we're giving people. Second, I think the fact that you don't come out with this, quote, built-in network, frankly, makes you work harder.
Yeah.
It's back to my idea earlier where there's not a lot of people to, quote, help you along. You figure it out. Well, guess what? How many entrepreneurs you had in here who sat in this chair didn't figure it out? I mean, they didn't get a lot of help. Most of them figured it out, right? Because there was something driven about them. And so I think that piece is a huge part of this as well. What we're doing intentionally now, though, is, okay, so we have the success, but is it, it seems almost unintentional, right? It's something that happens while you're at Marquette, but I can't describe it to you. So we started to add some programs. So for example, one of them is about 6 years ago, we instituted for the first time an actual undergraduate leadership development program in the College of Engineering. Now, people say they have leadership development programs. What I would tell you is almost every school I've seen, they're management programs. I actually mean leadership. So this is about, it starts out with leading yourself, really understanding who you are, then how do you lead others? And what you start to realize is leading others has everything to do with you and nothing to do with the others. And then the third part is actually leading innovation and taking them through examples and thoughts of what does this feel and look like? And so we're becoming much more intentional. So that's actually what drew me back to Marquette. You know, I'm retired CEO, someone might say recovering CEO. Yeah. You know, you do 65 earnings calls and you need a break from that. And so I think what's happening is now is we see that there are things we can do to add to the Marquette experience you had, but and in some way start to develop that thinking process. And so that's where we've started. Part of it is some of the work we're doing around just getting the students more involved in some thought leadership exercises. I'd say today we're in the early stages of it. Where we want to go is, frankly, we'll start to engage a more multidisciplinary approach. So this is the first year we're going to have students in the leadership program from multiple colleges. So we're purposely bringing a multidisciplinary approach to an undergrad education, which generally doesn't happen, right? You sit in your college silo. Let's face it, you walk out of college, it's all multidisciplinary. And so leadership, you learn a lot more trying to lead people not like you than learning those to lead those like you. So it's those types of things we're working on that I think is kind of our first step. So that's where we're starting.
What do you think is the piece that, like, if you were hiring at Cree, obviously you talked about what you were looking for, what you weren't looking for. What do you think you're seeing right now in students that are coming out of colleges that are, like, that they don't have, that attributes and traits they don't have, and those that you think that they do have that you can help with and that Marquette will differentiate with?
So I think that all students leave with knowledge.
Yep.
And the reality is knowledge is the least valuable thing we can give them. So if you think about where technology is going, artificial intelligence is going to make the acquisition of knowledge completely automated. And so anything that's about memorizing something or repeat, rinse and repeat, we're going to be able to automate that. What we can't automate is really things around creativity and compassion. And so I think those are the things we can teach. And frankly, that plays into a more rounded education, which is not just about what did you learn technically, right? So we have to take people through what I will think. I think it's going to look more experiential. So today, I'd say most college experiences are 80% theoretical, 20% experiential or applied, rough numbers. I think a decade from now, that's flipped. And I think it's flipped for two reasons. One, I think that's what the market demands. And two, if you look at higher ed as a business, higher ed as a business is going to go through some radical change. You know, Clayton Christensen came out a couple of years ago and said he predicts 50% of the 4,000 colleges and universities in the United States go bankrupt in the next 15 years.
Yep.
We haven't had an industry – that's a pretty radical transformation for an industry. And, you know, people talk about how tough it's been in the newspaper business. Well, you're That's a pretty radical change. I think that's going to force us to go, what do employers value? And I think what employers are starting to value more is people with experiential or applied knowledge, because that's the stuff that's hard to do. So frankly, we need people to go to college. They need to practice leading each other.
Yeah.
Not just practice taking a calculus test.
No, I totally agree. I think, honestly, when I think back on my experience at Marquette, I didn't sign up for that. Like, I didn't realize that I was doing, but I think out of force of being in a new place and having a penchant for going out and things like that, I put myself in sort of a situation where I was always trying to figure it out. And I honestly, God, I think my advantage as an entrepreneur and business runner now is that in school, I did a little bit of memorization and like showed up for the test and did that, but then otherwise was like scrambling to figure out how I was going to make this thing work. And grad school was not much different, to be totally honest. But I do think that that's like a benefit. And I think the more we give kids the opportunity to dabble in different things and not pin them into like, you're an engineer, you're going to do this, I think it's a huge advantage.
Well, and I think it's important to understand though, that there's a bit of a science behind this. Doing this when students are in their undergrad is way more impactful than doing it to a 30-year-old going back to business school.
Yeah, totally.
Because if you look at just the psychology of it, our behaviors are a function of our belief system. And your belief system, most psychologists will tell you, is really pretty fixed by about the time you're 25.
Yep.
So we have undergrads at a perfect age where they know enough that we can give them these ideas and help give them these belief systems to let them do things that
They're building their foundation.
Right.
I mean, this is everything.
But if we wait, you know, I did most of my leadership development work on my team. They're in their 40s. Oh. It's really hard to take someone who's 40 years old that thinks one way and get them to believe different things. That's a long, slow process. In their 18 to 22-year-olds, this is a perfect answer. So I think it's not only the thing we should do. I think there's an opportunity to do it where it's the most productive, right? We have the biggest ability to make an impact at that age than we'll ever have again.
So I have to, before we let you out of here, I have to talk about the content guy part of this, because you're an author, you got the podcast, you're a speaker. That's my world. I think it's fascinating to not only discuss what you're doing and what you're creating, but also the why behind it, because I if you go on a podcast, there's a podcast for every person on earth. There might be two podcasts for every person on earth, and books are the same. What I notice about them is that people talk about stuff that is sort of a waste of time, and it's like, pump you up, rah, 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 don't do this, and like gets lots of clicks, but it's not actually like good stuff. And I look at like Jim Collins and other people, and I also look at those, particularly those who have run Fortune companies or public companies, because they have a unique insight that very few people have had to be under that pressure cooker. And I find those to be the most fascinating. I would love to know what drives you to create things and to write a book and what the purpose is. Is it cathartic? Is it giving back? Is it a little column A, column B? And then ultimately, when people receive it, what is the takeaway and does it surprise you?
So the book is finished but not out. It will come out in May. Why did I write it? So I was giving a speech at Marquette about my experience leading Cree. And I was really trying to give people a sense of what it was like to develop the first LED light bulb and convince people to buy it, which was a really unique experience. So we're sitting here under LED light, but I started pitching LEDs when everyone told me no one would ever buy it.
Yeah.
And I was told by the lighting companies, we'll never need LED because what we have is good enough.
Yep.
So I went on this journey that was really an interesting experience. So I was sharing that. And as I was describing it, I got done with my speech and a couple people came up to me. One of them was the dean of the College of Engineering and a person that runs their leadership program. And they said, you said some stuff that's actually quite different than what most other people say. Would you look at our course? So I audited the course privately. I sat at home for a month and a half. And I read everything. And I went back and I said, this stuff won't work. And most of it came from large business schools, where they bought the curriculum material. And this is about innovation leadership specifically. Sure. And what it was is they had created – there was this idea that let us give you kind of a recipe to innovation. And if you follow these steps, you'll get there. And I'm like, excuse me. It doesn't work. I lived it. I did it. It doesn't work. And I competed with the companies that tried that, and they're not in the business anymore. So I was pretty confident. I thought that was my role, right? Tell them what doesn't work, move on. And they go, that's really cool. You need to write us a book so we can use it. And so honestly, Scott, I never intended to write a book. I tried it, didn't go real well. Someone convinced me that you hire a ghostwriter to help you out. So I learned I could tell a bunch of stories, and they helped me put this together. And it was the first time I ever actually thought about what we did at Cree. If we had this conversation when I was still CEO of Cree, I couldn't answer most of these questions you're asking because I hadn't thought about it. I just did it. It was who we were. It was how he acted. It was cultural. It was not conscious thought. Now that I've had a chance to step away, I've been able to kind of try to explain what it looks like and take it apart, which has been super interesting for me. I don't know what people think about it because it hasn't come out yet. The podcast was a way then to go, okay, that was pretty cool. But there's innovation conversations that happen every day. And the thing that started to bother me when I was writing the book is everyone thinks it's a tech company thing.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, I know so many people that have this mindset that are doing innovation that doesn't look like tech. And so the podcast was meant to create a forum to have conversations on all kinds of subjects. So I think, as you know, I interviewed the head men's basketball coach, Steve Wojciechowski, because innovation affects the game of basketball, right? As those rules change, if you don't innovate, you get fired.
Yep.
And so this idea of, you know, a bunch of short guys being the game dominated by guards in a game that 20 years ago looked quite different. Or
no positions in the game anymore.
Yeah, it's positionless. And so it was really interesting. How do you think about that? And one of the things I discovered in having these conversations was I'm talking to him and it dawns on me, I'm probably sitting across from someone that knows more about recruiting than anyone I've ever met professionally.
Yep.
His entire life is based on the idea of convincing people to come play for them. And like, he's the world's recruiting expert. All these coaches are. And you go, wow. And so we got into a conversation where I started to realize there are these common themes from successful people across all different areas that if you can break it down into the commonalities, it's something I think we can give to people to be reused. And what I want to do is make it not about what did I do to make Cree successful or what does it take to be a good basketball coach or how do you run a large retailer, but how are you thinking? Because if someone can embrace the thought process behind it, you can apply it to anything else. And part of the idea is to break it down into these pieces that can be reused over and over again. And so that's where the podcast came from. That's been really interesting. I'll be honest, it's a lot easier to be interviewed than to be the interviewer.
Yeah.
You know, you're press trained to be a public company CEO and you do enough interviews over time, you learn to say nothing.
Yep. The best ones say a lot, but say nothing.
And you have to, because your job is to basically, you know, not get sued or file an 8K as it accidentally as
a result
of
saying
something, right?
Yes, I didn't.
Or have your investor mad at you. I mean, you're literally sitting there trying to say as little as possible and sound intelligent. And it's quite hard to do. And I'm not sure I did it all that well as it was. Now,
seems, you know, like things went all right.
Well, now I got to get people, though, to try to talk to me and get into some stuff that they normally wouldn't talk about. And so it's been really interesting. And it's I'm so naturally curious. It's fun. They're not all great. But to me, it's another form of content. And it's really meant to be, why do I do it? Look, I'm not going to make any money writing a book. And the podcast, I'm a volunteer, right? So this is about, could I share some ideas that will help others do it? It's a bit selfish. I learn every time I do it. And I don't, one of my big goals is, can we take this idea of innovative thinking and make it a more intentional thing? I don't know how to do that yet, but I'm kind of on this journey of exploring as I talk to people. I think there's a way to do it. And that would be one of the things I'd like to accomplish here over the next 5 years. I just don't know quite where to start yet. So I'm collecting data.
Honestly, this is the same thing. I love talking to entrepreneurs and innovators and CEOs and people, because to me, it's like, I just get to read. I read your book just now, you know, talking. Obviously, there's more in the book than we talked about, but there's an opportunity to sit back and listen to people and throw things at them and see what they come back at you with. And you're just like, I never would have phrased it that way. I never would have thought it that way. So I think it's fascinating. I also think that a lot of CEOs and companies now are more open to hearing your experiences and your opinions and your things that they previously wouldn't have been. It would have been sort of like, I don't seek help. I don't get mentors and things. And I'm not a big mentor person, even though I do mentor and I, you know, that kind of thing. But like, I'm more of a, to your kind of point, I'm more self-reliant and like to learn and try things myself and then figure it out. And I ask for help when I know I need it. But I think it's all kind of a myth, because the reality is I listen to so many people like you all day that like I have all these mentors that just don't, you know, they don't know it.
Well, and I think that's the challenge. You know, the mentor concept's an interesting one, because people ask me, did I have one? And maybe the one of the original Cree founders is someone that
informally.
Yeah, I mean, but he was more of a, you know, he was more of a very difficult person to deal with than I would consider a mentor.
So I have the same story. When I got started, my mentor would be like, I don't want to say mentor because it actually kind of irks me. And this is not saying that this is your situation, but I don't want to give them that. It's not negative, but I don't want to give them that satisfaction because it wasn't a friendly necessarily exchange for me, but I learned more from them than ever before. And in fact, the fact that they were hard on me actually made it more worthwhile for me.
Oh, I have no doubt the person had my best interest and the company's best interest at heart, but the approach was brutal.
Yeah.
But I learned a ton. And I think what we confuse on mentoring is it makes me crazy when people think of it as, hey, would you be my mentor? You're supposed to help me. And the answer is first of all, the only time that works is if it's a two-way street. Yeah. It's only going to work if both people get something out of it. And two, it's generally the person that is seeking advice has to create a compelling reason for it to happen. And I think, to your point, the people that I've met that are very successful are always learning. They're learning from every experience that happens to them every day. And that's part of it, is you have to pay attention to your world. It's whether what you do and you get to meet different – me meeting podcast guests or me just – I get something out of almost every experience, every day, something I do, there's something to be learned. And I think that's part of it is I think you have to have some curiosity to do this.
This is kind of off in a tangent here, but I know that you hold board positions and advise. And I think there's a fascinating sort of, I know a handful of entrepreneurs, very successful entrepreneurs, who will openly tell you that they meet smart people and they make them advisors. They give them shares in their company and they really don't ask that many questions. And the board just sort of knows, like, this is how much shares are going to be available to these people because I met someone who's a very, very smart individual that can help me down the line. I don't really have this isn't willy-nilly. Like, I'm not just throwing equity out. But I don't necessarily have an ask right now, but I know I will. And I know that they're a guide. And those entrepreneurs have been very, very successful. And I've had the good fortune of working with some of them. Then there are entrepreneurs and people in general who will just like, they think they're hiring you as an advisor. And I'm so reticent. I learned the hard way. But I'm so reticent to get in relationships like that now where they expect like I work for you. An advisor or a mentor should be somebody who literally, to your point, is sort of a push and pull where there might be equity because I'm busy and I'm going to give you something that's valuable. But it should not be like, okay, now I got 2 points to you. Give me 25 introductions and do all this work for me. You're like, no, wait a minute. Like, and I'm just wondering your standpoint on this because you're going to be, if you haven't already, you're going to get a bombarding of people who are going to ask you to be an advisor, not only because of the Cree experience, but working with college students and the whole innovation podcast and everything else. Where do you stand in this whole piece?
So today I have 4 boards. 3 are private, 1's public. Public board is a much more traditional relationship, but I joined it because I felt like what the CEO wanted was an advisory role. It was, that you have to follow the rules of being in a public company, but the relationship that I was interested in was, is there someone that I thought at some point I could be helpful to, but at the same time, we were going into this where I'm going to come up to speed, let me learn, and let's see how we're going to figure this out as we go. And it has been a great relationship to where there's been a couple things I think I was able to add some value, but most days in a public company, you don't want your board helping you too much. In fact, what I would tell you is in a public company, if the board is helping the CEO, what the board should be asking is, when are they getting a new CEO?
Yeah.
So I think you got to be really careful on that. In a private company, you get a different range, right? Because advisor board member in a private company is kind of a more common idea. The 3 that I'm on, though, I would say I am not part of management. I am helping as an advisor. I have different relationships with all of them. I would say that, it's in one case, I think I'm actually probably playing more of a mentor role. So it's a young CEO who's trying to build a semiconductor company.
Yep.
I've been there, done that. So I can be helpful.
Pretty
right?
Good there. Yeah.
And so I can take you there. And other ones, there are ones in biotech, which I never was involved with before. But honestly, inventing new technology, the challenges, the people stuff, it's pretty much the same thing. And one of them is actually a brewery.
Yeah.
And that's just purely a nuts and bolts.
You just like beer.
I do. Actually, that's how I got involved. Yeah. I was an investor first. And so I think all those roles, I think it just varies at each situation. I think the key is, though, is both parties need to go into those relationships eyes open. And I think, the best advice I got when I was considering boards was meet the management and decide is, do you feel compelled to want to help them, whether they need your help or not? Are you motivated to want to make them successful as an executive or as a leader? If the answer is yes, it's probably a good board. If the answer is anything but yes, you have better spend your time better elsewhere. And so for me, choosing these boards was really by getting to know the management first, because at the end of the day, that That's why you're there, to try to make management successful. And yes, if they're not, you have to replace them, but that should be your first goal. And so I think that's kind of how I've approached it.
And I honestly, I would say on the other side of this, alternatively, as a founder looking for advisors, I think you don't necessarily, like, if you don't have anything you need advising on, you don't have mentorship. I mean, you do, you just don't know it. Don't just grab people just to grab people. I think that's the number one thing here.
Yeah. Even as a public company, when I built my public company board, I actually hired people that had completely different talent. So most people would think tech company, have a bunch of tech people. I had the former chairman and CEO of GlaxoSmithKline. I had the head of Lowe's Home Improvement. I tried to find people with very different experiences, because what I found, especially as I did it longer, is I needed different ideas. I needed people to create. I needed insights and perspectives from places that I didn't have access to. I had tons of access to the market I was in. And I would think I think advisors from places that are not in your area of expertise are the most important.
Oh, totally agree.
And I think too often when I look at company boards, they hire a bunch of people that know all the same things.
Cutouts from the same place.
Like, that's the only thing you don't need. I mean, and so, you know, honestly, I think, you know, being in a life sciences company, it has been tremendously interesting for me. So I'm getting something out of intellectually. But the things I think I've been able to be helpful on are the things that aren't as obvious to the people that live in that business every day.
Thank you very much. This is awesome. I hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's great.
For any startup questions, DM me on Instagram at Technori or at Katoon. To apply to pitch on the Startup Showcase live on WGN Radio, go to technori.com. Boom, that's a wrap.